So the picture that encodes today's calculation is something like that. With the four strings coming in. This is related to applying the proper well factor to a sphere with four punctures. Conversely, if I give a sphere with four punctures, you can pick a well factor which blows up exponentially the neighborhood of each puncture into a tube. You can do this for a sphere with punctures in any possible position. As you remember yesterday, we saw that even after you fix the metric to be flat or spherical, you're left with some residual gauge freedom, which are coordinate transformations of this form. This allows you to move around however you want through the punctures, and only the position of the fourth puncture will be meaningful. So essentially, you expect the moduli space of non-trivial matrix on this surface moduli diffeomorphisms and wild transformations to be one complex dimensional and correspond roughly to the position of one of these points with the other three kept fixed. Now, when we did the gauge fixing properly, we wrote down how to deal with moduli spaces of gauge fixing conditions, moduli spaces of convex structures in this case. So we said that you can do the usual path integral but you also need to include an integral over the moduli on these complex structures or these complex surfaces. Insertions for your strings, but also some B insertions, which we schematically wrote in this form. So for some generic gauge fixing condition, you see how the gauge fixing condition varies with respect to the moduli. You contract it at the big host corresponding to that gauge fixing condition. You multiply over the moduli. You can see this expression is in particular invariant under different choices of how to parametrize your moduli, because this, if you change coordinates from n to some m primes, this changes by the Jacobian, the terminator of the Jacobian. This matrix changes by the Jacobian, but because the big hosts are fermionic, you get everything is anti-symmetric with respect to this index. And effectively, you get something totally anti-symmetric in the moduli, so a determinant of the Jacobian. Anyway, so I'm not going to use this formula because it's too unnecessarily complicated for the purpose of three-level amplitudes. So if I wanted to do things very properly, I would start in my gauge fixing conditions, which, as you remember, just consisted of the, so Fi was just the metric, which was then contracted with the capital B, the traceless part of the metric. So roughly, this is the variation of the metric with respect to the moduli contracted to the big host. But it turns out that, okay, and this together with the insertions corresponding to the various external string states. Okay. Now it turns out that if you parametrize your moduli by the position of some of the punctures, this factor essentially kills in its conjugate, sorry, kills the C insertions for the corresponding puncture. So here I have N C's and C bars and N minus 3 B's, but if you do the calculation carefully, you see that the B's are inserted in precisely in such a way to cancel some of the C's, and you're just left with 3 C's. So, but I would like to give a more direct argument for that statement without going through the detailed derivation, which is a little bit unpleasant. It's unpleasant mostly because you need to go back to a formalism where you work with an explicit metric. You cannot do things in the conformal language directly. Well, you can, but you need to introduce a lot of notions which we don't have and we will not be able to get in this lecture, like how to parameterize complex structures of a Riemann surface, Beltrami differentials and all of that. So the expression I would like to get to is that a three-level amplitude can be written as an integral over the position of the punctures, except for the first three, say that which have been fixed. And the first three punctures would have still their C insertions. The V's represent the whatever operators encode the matter, the state of the matter fields for the incoming strings. Okay, so essentially the statement is that for computing three-level amplitudes, you can just throw away the V's, don't worry about the V's, integrate to the position of the punctures, except for the first three, and throw away the C's for the corresponding operators. Now, so I would like to give two pieces of information before we start using this formula. One is so that this formula still makes sense. And the second is to show a quick derivation of it. Now, to see that this formula makes sense, we must make sure that BRST symmetry still works. See, this insertion, we know that these insertions are Q close. They're killed by the BRST symmetry. Because we've shown that states of the form matter field, tensor, ground state, or the ghosts are killed by Q as long as M is a primary and is killed by appropriate Virasoro modes. But here, for these guys, we're looking at something slightly different. We're looking at things that look like matter field tensor with a vacuum, which is, if you remember, is V minus 1 acting on the ground state. So this definitely is not Q closed. If you act with Q on this, you can pass it across B minus 1 and kill the state. But when you pass it across B minus 1, it gives something non-trivial. You get L minus 1 on the state. As you remember, L minus 1 corresponds to taking the derivative of the operator. So if I act with Q, say, on this guy, I end up with C the Z4 before Z4. So this is non-zero, but is a total derivative. And so it still cancels out when you do the integral, assuming boundary conditions work properly. Now, this is actually not different from what happens here. Here, the individual instructions are Q closed, but if you add to Q on these insertions, they actually give you precisely the variation of the action with respect to the modulus. And so again, they integrate to zero. So they are Q, this expression is Q closed only after integrating over the moduli space of complex structures. So there is a very close relation between this and this. See, in both cases, here we're using Z4 as a modulus, and so we get the derivative bit of Z4. Here we're using some generic modulus parameterization, we get a generic partial derivative. Essentially, you can take this, you can integrate it by parts because there is an e to the s, right, the path integral, and then it ends up acting on the local operators. I'm saying it very poorly. In this way of writing things, the local operators are inserted at some points that are kept fixed, and you're only changing the metric. So the moduli only enter inside the action, and this integrates by parts to zero. Here, instead, we move some of the moduli in the position of the punctures. And so we get an out of the action. And so we get partial derivative respect to the positions, but the principle is still the same. This integrates to zero. So BRC symmetry is still going to work with this expression. Now, there is a neat way to find this expression by going, instead of starting from this, you can get it by going back to the unfixed, gauge unfixed problem, changing it just a little bit, and then gauge fixing it again. You can get here. So it's not quite a rigorous proof that this is the same as this, but at least should give you a good intuition of why this is working. So here the original problem what we are studying is we take this surface with these cubes going out and we studied metrics on this surface, right? So here we have a path integral, which is the metric over the matrix on this surface, just like that, with some specific boundary conditions to the tubes, divided by the diffeomorphisms of this surface. So again, diffeomorphisms that have a very specific behavior at infinity. In particular, they don't blow up along the tubes. But once we accept the idea that we can use the state operator map and replace the tubes with points, then an alternative way to think about this is that we just consider generic matrix on the Riemann surface, on the sphere, together with generic choices of where to put the punctures. So I can try to rewrite the integral as a path integral over the matrix on the sphere and on the position of the punctures, all of them. Okay. Divided by the diffeomorphisms of the sphere. So essentially, when you go from here to here, roughly speaking, you've added a numerator, a bunch of integral of the position of the punctures, but at the same time, you made the diffeomorphism, the space of diffeomorphisms, bigger. What's the difference between these diffeomorphisms and these diffeomorphisms? The difference between these two is precisely a diffeomorphism which locally just moves the puncture a little bit. If you look at the state operator map, you'll find that diffeomorphisms that don't blow up here leave the point fixed. And if you allow the point to move a little bit, you're adding an extra diffeomorphism. which precisely cancels this at the numerator. But now we can try to gauge fix this. And so what do we need to do to gauge fix this? Well, first of all, we can say I want the metric to be conformally flat. Okay, I want it to be my round sphere metric, say. Up to conform transformation. But I also, this doesn't fix on the sphere, this doesn't fix the diffeomorphism completely because there is still this freedom. So I need to gauge fix this. So to these gauge fixing conditions, I need to add something else. Let me just say I set Z1 to some specific value, Z2 to some specific value, Z3 to some specific value. That would be my gauge fixing. So that means essentially my gauge fixing conditions include these, which is implemented by the usual big ghosts, and these three discrete conditions, which are implemented by a few three extra degrees of freedom. For example, so to do this, I want to have essentially a delta function of z1 minus z1 hat, and so on. I can realize it by e to the I b1 z1 minus z1 hat, but this is some extra Lagrange multiplier. And then I'll complete this to the usual BST exact expression by introducing a big ghost for these. And then I need the variation of these with respect to diffeomorphisms. Now, if I add to the vector field on the position, it just changes the position by the vector field. So I end up with something like the C ghost evaluated at Z1. Okay. Now, these are just some finite-dimensional integral. I can just do it. The one on this gives me the delta function. The one on B1 gives me a C insertion. Okay. So this is the meaning of this expression. So each of the, from that point of view, each of the C's is naturally accompanying the delta function which fixed the position of Z1 or Z2 or Z3. And all the other positions are just integrated over because that was my measure. So this is a sort of quick and dirty derivation of this expression. Now let's put it to some use. So let's look at four tachyons. So we have C, C bar, e to the I, B1, X, and C1. C, C bar, e to the I, B2, X, and Z2. C, C bar, e to the I, B3, X, and Z3. And then e to the I, B4, X, and Z4. Integrated over Desi four bar. Okay. Do you have any questions? Okay, then let's compute it. Okay, so this is the usual contribution from the vertex operators and from the ghosts involving these three operators. And then I need the contribution from these other pairs of operators. Okay, I need a little integral. Now, let's look at this integral a little bit more carefully. First of all, is it convergent? Well, there are four places it could go wrong. It could go wrong at infinity, or it could go wrong at the position of the other punctures. So the behavior at infinity is very simple. When z4 is very large, it behaves like z4 to the power of 2p4 sum over the pi's. So using momentum conservation, this is just z to the minus 2p4 squared, which is z to the minus 4. That's a pretty reasonable convergent behavior. Now, at the position of the other punctures, things are a little bit less obviously okay. So this integral, as z4 approaches zi, will only converge if 2p4 dot pi is greater than or equal than minus 2. Greater, just greater, not greater than equal. When it because locally you have an integral of the form the z bar z to the 2 alpha and you're looking at the behavior as z goes to 0, you can parameterize z equal to r e to the I phi. And this looks like an integral in the r to the 2 alpha plus 1. Okay, so this is convergent if this power is bigger than minus 1, which means 2 alpha bigger than minus 2. Now, if you think about that, if you think that string theory is actually close to quantum field theory, and you remember the very second lecture, this bound is actually not so surprising. So we developed the path integral of the strings in analogy to the path integral of the free particle, of quantum field theory, and we are rewriting those Feynman diagrams by replacing the propagators in the quantum field theory with some proper time representations. Okay. Now this formula is only valid if this is positive. I cannot use this formula if this square is bigger than minus m squared. Where p is the momentum of an intermediate leg. Now, if you look at this condition a little bit, you can rewrite it as pi plus p4 squared greater than 2. So this is the condition that the momentum, if this was quantum field theory, this would be the condition that the momentum going in the intermediate leg of a diagram looking like this satisfies this constraint. So there are two ways to deal with this. One is convenient, the other is physically good, they're equivalent. So in quantum field theory, what would you do? Well, an alternative way to do things is to rewrite the propagator as in terms of a Lorentzian proper time. Is actually pretty useful if you want to use to introduce I epsilon prescriptions too. Now the I epsilon in the propagator makes this convergent. I don't remember if I should put a plus or a minus here. I forget. One of the two is the right way to do Lorentz continuation, weak rotation. Right, so a way to deal with this is just to do weak rotation of the proper time. And you could do something similar here. So usually when you write this integral, it's intended Z4 bar is defined as just the complex conjugate of Z4. But the integrand is just the product of the function of Z and a function of Z bar. So this is something that can be analytically continued to Z4 bar different from Z4, from the conjugate of Z4. So you can look at this as some sort of contour integral in C2 in the complex plane squared, which is done on this contour. And this can be deformed to other contours of integration, much in the same way as this, as here we deform tau to IT. This is actually the correct way to deal with I epsilon prescriptions in string theory. There were some recent papers on the topic. And picking the if you pick the correct contour, something that behaves like this, you can actually this becomes convergent for every value of the momentum. Alternatively, you can just compute it when this condition holds, and then analytically continuing the momentum to general values of the momentum. The two procedures are equivalent, and the latter is the one that you usually find in textbooks. So in Polchinski, he's going to just tell you, compute it when this condition holds, and then you get an analytic function of the momenta, and take that as the expression for every value of the momentum. And this is the physics that is hidden behind that prescription. Okay, so now this looks like a pretty daunting integral. It's not as bad as it looks. It's useful to the change of coordinate. Essentially, this is a new coordinate. This is one specific case of this transformation, which sends z1, z2, z3 at 0, 1, and infinity, and z4 at t. It's called the cross ratio. It's very important. You do conformal field theory. And this reduces the integral to something much simpler. The main reason I wrote this is because I wanted to show that this is symmetric, at least among the functions z1, z2, z3. Now, this is a relative of the beta integral. I don't know if you've ever encountered it. Integral of t to the alpha, 1 minus t to the beta. And it can be evaluated in a similar manner. Okay, this is called the Virasoro-Shapiro amplitude. is also, I mean, you can also express it in terms of the Mandelstam variables. So let's see what's the physics. There is a huge amount of physics hidden in this expression. It just takes a little bit of effort to unpack. So the first question you should ask, what are the poles of this amplitude? In the quantum field theory, the poles are associated to the particles which are exchanged in intermediate diagram. Intermediate moment leg of the Feynman diagram. So the poles come from the gamma function of the numerator. If you remember, gamma function has poles as 0, minus 1, minus 2, minus 3. So the poles live at p4 dot pi equal to minus 1, minus 2, minus 3. Which is the same as p4 plus pi squared equal to 2, 0, minus 2, minus 4, etc. So you see this expression is definitely accounting for as a quantum field theory expression, is definitely accounting for the propagation of a tachyon, some massless field, some field of mass 2, mass square 2, mass square 4, and so on, both in the S, in the T, and in the U channel. So this expression seems to be capturing Feynman diagrams that correspond to the propagation of all sort of intermediate particles, all the particles which you have seen when we were discussing the spectrum of the string theory. Actually, you can compute the residue of A4 as you approach these poles. We can compute, for example, the residue of A4 as P4 dot P1 approaches minus n. And you get some expression with gamma functions. Basic momentum conservation. But this ratio of gamma functions just telescopes to a polynomial. So if you just use the recursion for the gamma function, this becomes something like product . So this denominator is a polynomial in the momenta of degree 2 of n minus 1, which is reasonable. The tachyon was a scalar field, so you get just a propagator. The massless mode was a graviton, so the interaction involves the momentum of the particles the graviton is interacting with. We even computed the 3-point vertex. So it's reasonable to have a second order polynomial in the momenta here, and so on. The higher string modes carry a lot of Lorentz indices. So their interaction vertex with the tachyon has a lot of momentum. And these momenta end up in the denominator here. So it definitely looks like if you look at the pulse in the S channel, this amplitude is reproducing all sorts of diagrams like this. But on the other hand, we can also rewrite it as a sum over pulse in the T channel. Or as a sum of poles in the U channel. This is a very magical property of this amplitude. And actually, people guessed this amplitude before learning how to compute it from string theory. Just from looking for some function with a magical property that it could simultaneously describe propagation of all the S-channel diagrams for infinite number of particles, or the T-channel diagrams, or the U-channel diagrams. Now, it's reasonable to ask how is this working? How does this amplitude manage to do that? So to understand that, we can go back to this integral. So where do the poles come from? Suppose, for example, I wanted to focus on the region of the integration where t is very small. Okay. Then I could just expand this in a Taylor series, in powers of t. And I will get a sum of integrals of t to the 2 p4 dot p1 plus 2n with some coefficients in front. polynomials in V2.before. So if I just do this integral from 0 to some cutoff, I precisely get this sort of poles. So now t approaching 0 is the same as z4 approaching z1. So we have this sort of integral on the z4 plane with the special points z1, z2, z3. And when you integrate it in this region, you reproduce the poles in the S channel. You integrate it on this region, you reproduce the poles in the T channel. When you integrate it in this region, you reproduce the poles in the U channel. Now, so this T4 was for us a way to parameterize the metric on this surface. So you can ask, what kind of matrix correspond to this region, or this region, or this region? Well, it turns out that in this region, the surface looks like this. This is the one, well, before. So these are precisely the regions where this picture of the string Warchi starts resembling the picture of the Feynman diagram. So these are the matrix on the Riemann surface where your string Warchi looks like a fattened up Feynman diagram. Okay. So now starting from this picture, we could make a more precise analysis. For example, a companion of the state operator map correspondence, or I mean, the general property of quantum field theories, is that if you have a picture like this, you can sort of cut it. And insert here a complete set of states for the theory in a cylinder. So if you do that, you get essentially a trivalent vertex here, a trivalent vertex here, and then a tube joined by a tube of variable length. And the length of the tube and the way it enters in the amplitude is precisely behaving the same way as this parameter here. At the length of the word line. So that shows you that explicitly, if you want, that the four-point function will be written as a sum of product of interaction vertices computed from three-point functions and propagators. This is the basic reason string theory behaves like quantum field theory. That these complicated Riemann surfaces in appropriate patches of their moduli spaces can be cut, chopped up into small pieces, into trinions, connected by long tubes. And the long tubes behave like particles, like particle propagators. And the trinions behave like vertices of Feynman diagram. This holds at three level, this holds at one loop, and so on. There is even something called string field theory, which really does this chopping up analysis carefully and writes string theory as a kind of quantum field theory with infinitely many fields. it's usually a very cumbersome way to do calculations. And I would say it still has to find its killer application, but it's something that is possible. Now, although in the appropriate limits, string theory looks like quantum field theory, there are other limits in which it definitely doesn't. So this is telling you that if you look at situations where you have a long propagation of particles, essentially means these two scattering things are not coming too close to each other, they're not going too fast, then you resemble string theory, quantum field theory. On the other hand, you can definitely find regimes in the kinematics where this amplitude does not look like quantum field theory at all. For example, there is a canonical limit where you look at scattering that happens at very high energy and see what comes out at a certain angle. This is a regime where S, T, and U are sent to infinity, but their ratios are kept fixed, I believe. So the arguments of all these gamma functions are going to infinity. You can use the Stirling formula, and you get the behavior that looks like e to the minus s log s minus t log t minus u log u. So in this limit, the scattering amplitude becomes exponentially suppressed. You're throwing these strings very hard at each other, and they just pass through each other. They're not point particles, they're fluffy. So this fluffiness at high energy is part of the reason string theory does not have UV divergences. Okay, do you have any questions about this four-point function? Mm-hmm. So it's a bit of an indirect way. So you can take your surface, your sphere with points in position, let's just say 0, 1, infinity, and z4. Okay? Well, this should really be t. Then let me pick a wild factor to put on top of this metric. So I want to put this with dz, dz bar, e to the phi metric. I want this wild factor to behave near each puncture. Let me just write it z1, z2, z3. To behave near each puncture the same way as it did when in the state operator map. So I want it to blow up exponentially. So I hope I remembered correctly. You can pick various choices. I believe this might work, but you should check me on this. Something like that, I believe, could work. See, near as z approaches each of the punctures, this behaves like z minus zi squared, which is the behavior that gives you the semi-infinite flat tune. Okay. So each of these gives me a metric on this picture. And now I claim that these metrics are all inequivalent. They cannot be related by coordinate transformations. And every metric on this surface can be reduced to this form by wild transformation. So that's how the matrix on the surface get converted to the position of one of the punctures. But I'm using heavily the idea that conformal transformations are holomorphic coordinate transformations and all of these sort of theorems of differential geometry, which I never even stated during the lecture. And but you can see it happen concretely, meaning you can literally take this expression for specific values of Z and just look at the picture that you get. And especially if you're in the regime where Z4 approaches Z1, Z2, or Z3, you should see these sort of pictures emerge. And from these sort of pictures, it's pretty clear that these are independent matrix in the sense that if I have a very long tube, it's hard to get rid of it with a wild transformation. Because when I do a wild transformation, it makes the tube shrink or get bigger. So at least in this region, I can sort of gauge fix wild transformation by saying I want the diameter of the tube to be constant. And then the length is a gauge invariant notion. Because I cannot change the length without also changing the diameter. So this is actually a pretty good way to think about it, meaning thinking about the matrix in terms of trinions glued together by tubes whose length is a gauge invariant notion. And then from here you can go to the sphere with punctures. Yes. I mean, I just made it up now, so but I think it's correct.
I'm kind of wondering, when we had Feynman diagrams, those were kind of like a helping tools to construct the amplitude.
Yes.
But here, the picture you've drawn with the tubes is kind of a, like, more of a physical picture, right? Because it's dictated by the metric we get from the world. So do people actually think about those pictures as being like physical?
Well, the only truly physical thing is the embedding of that picture inside the space-time.
Yeah.
Now, in specific regimes, so the metric is an auxiliary quantity as much as the proper times are auxiliary quantities in the Feynman diagrams. Although in specific regimes, this might become physical in the sense that the amplitude might be, the integral you're doing might be picked over configurations where the proper length actually coincides with the length in space-time. Only in specific circumstances. So you might question how much physics is there in me writing down these two pictures. It's mostly intuitive, but it can be made precise. Any other questions? Now, it's easy to generalize this calculation to more tachyons or to more interesting particles. For example, we could do scattering of 4 gravitons. It's not much more complicated. The correlation function, the vertex operators are a little bit more complex. The integral is a little bit more complicated, but not much. You always end up with sort of gamma functions, perhaps with extra polynomials of the momentum. Now, computing loop amplitude is a different cup of tea. So the moduli space of complex structures on the Riemann surface with handles can be complicated. they're not as easily parametrized as the spatial complex structures on a sphere. One loop is still fine. When you do things as one loop, right, you want to look at pictures that. I wish I knew how to draw properly. This probably works. Okay. Which, by state of perfect map, are mapped to correlation functions on a torus. Now, I perhaps discuss very briefly how to describe the complex structures on a torus. A torus can be obtained by quotienting the plane by two translations, say translation by one, and by some complex parameter tau. So this is your generic torus after wild transformations. And then you have a bunch of local operators on it. And we are not going to do one loop amplitudes, unfortunately, although there is a lot of, we might be able to get to them next week, but I'm not sure. There are a lot of topics that can be fun to cover. When you do loop amplitudes, you can really see the string modes running in the loops, the same way as here we saw the string modes propagating in the tubes. Also, when you do loop amplitudes in bosonic string, you start noticing the bosonic string doesn't work because the tachyon propagating the loops start giving all sorts of troubles. But anyway, so I would say that loop amplitudes are still straightforward to compute. Integrating the positions of the functions on the torus is typically doable. Integrating all the modular parameter of the torus is a little bit more complicated, but can still be done. I think I will have to devote a little bit of time to this, but I'm not sure how much. We'll see. Now, in higher genus, things get more complicated. The modular space of Riemann surfaces is just tricky to parameterize. It's not just an easy patch of, I mean, it has a lot of corners of topology. So calculations in superstring theory, where there is no tachyon and things are well defined, at the moment I think have been pushed to three loops. It was quite a tour de force already. Of course, there is also the question of why would you want to compute amplitudes at high loops? Because it's not like you can check on the LHC the scattering of free strings. So it's more like the conceptual problem of making sure that you can do it if you have to. So that the theory is well defined, at least in perturbation theory. And for superstrings, that's technically quite challenging. But I think, again, the last few wrinkles have been ironed out over the last few years. It's much more interesting to find ways to probe non-perturbative aspects of string theory. So that's what that will be more the focus of the next week. Next week we'll do things like t-duality, d-brains. Now, tomorrow I would like to elaborate a little bit more on the relation between quantum field theory and string theory. So here we learn how to compute, at least in principle, scattering amplitudes. In principle, if somebody gives you scattering amplitudes, you can get out of it an effective action. So you could ask, can I write down an effective action for this tachyon, graviton, two-form field, dilaton, and what else, which encodes the low energy properties of the scattering amplitudes? The answer is yes, and there is actually a very instructive way to get to that effective action. which will make clear that principle that I expressed at the very beginning, that in string theory, every deformation of the theory is associated to a particle, and vice versa, every particle encodes a deformation of the theory. That will be tomorrow's topic. Any more questions? I think yes, but in string theory you don't use. So in string theory produces for you a measure of integration, in the sense that the integrand or the string amplitude wants to do the path integral over x, b, and c. Is just a top form on the moduli space, and you integrate that. Indeed, the whole PRST formalism makes sure that this is a closed form on the moduli space. And it changes by exact forms when you switch the external states, say by some Q exact states.